Yes, we plunge on in to our Leviticus study. This is our 14th class, as you can see here on April 17th. Now, we have looked at this outline quite a few times, so we'll fly through that. First seven chapters devoted to those five primary sacrifices, 8 through 10, gives us the establishment of the priesthood. Chapters 11 through 15, we have the distinguishing between clean and unclean, though we'll have a great deal of that yet that lies ahead of us. Now, it is, to some extent, one might say, interrupted by a chapter 16 on the Day of Atonement, highest, holiest day, the only day in which the Jews were required to be fasting. And then comes these last chapters, 17 through 26, "You shall be holy, for I am holy," is what we've entitled them, and particularly tonight, we'll see why. So we've already worked our way through last week, chapter 17, and then 18. I gave you this chart last week, some of you may have with you this evening, entitled Old Testament Sexual Prohibitions and Penalties. So this particular chart was limited to Old Testament passages, and as the columns that we've talked about before, so I'm going to review it tonight, but it lists a total, as you can see down here in the lower left corner. Yeah, I got the wrong chart. I forgot what I was doing. We've got here a list of 24, there it is, sexual sins in Leviticus, just in the book we're studying, an additional 6 in the book of Deuteronomy, so an entire list of 30 in just those two books. That's what I presented last week, and then Lee got to thinking, okay, which is always a good thing. And she came up to me and she said, "You know, I think it may not be accurate to that you've got them all on the list here." So she suggested two more, and I think certainly she's absolutely right. So while I did not reprint this chart for you tonight, it'd be the 15th time, and I thought I'd hold off another week, you know, so that I could reprint it maybe at the end of the class instead of doing one every week. But these two lines you will not see on the chart I handed out last week. Maybe the most obvious among them, and I guess it's just because I had, you know, Leviticus on the brain, that I did not get Exodus chapter 20, verse 14, "You shall not commit adultery," and Exodus chapter 20, verse 17, "You shall not covet your neighbor's wife," as being sexual sins. Now, one of those, of course, "You shall not commit adultery," we also found in Leviticus 18, so we've already seen that one. But that second line in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 17, "You shall not covet your neighbor's wife," that is not one that was found, you know, elsewhere on the list from last week. So, and eventually I'll reprint this and won't be changing it at least much, you know, for the rest of this year. excuse me. You know, I've noted here that Exodus 20 and 14 is in Leviticus 18 and verse 20, but what that does is changes this one sign. So there are actually 6 of these statements in the Old Testament that you'll actually find reiterated in the New Testament. "You shall not covet your neighbor's wife" is lusting after your neighbor's wife, as Jesus explained in, and now you won't have this chart, it's the same one, but what I did was switched over to New Testament, you know, prohibitions. Yeah, but it's the same list, and all I've done is highlight these 6 now in green and just put the verse references where you can find out of this very lengthy list, you can only find 6 of these that are actually mentioned in the New Testament. Unless Lee comes to see me next week. We'll add whatever ones we have to, but you know, charts are always being edited and doing the best we can with them. So just so you know, Exodus chapter 20 and verse 14, "You shall not commit adultery." You'll find all that form there in Romans 13, verse 9. "You shall not covet your neighbor's wife" is exactly what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount at Matthew chapter 5 and verse 28. And then Leviticus 18:8, where a son may not have his father's wife, is, of course, identified in 1 Corinthians 5, verse 1. Recently, we went through that chapter on Sunday mornings. And then down here in Leviticus 18:22, where homosexuality is forbidden, is found in Romans chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. And then again, we've been studying 1 Corinthians and have come through 5 and 6 in the last couple of weeks. So, the prostitution is at least referenced in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 15. So we pointed that out in our 1 Corinthians class. But it's kind of not the same, in a way at least, as the statement in Leviticus 19, which we haven't even looked at yet. We'll do tonight. But on your chart at verse 29, which says, "You shall not make your daughter a harlot." That would be, you know, a very active kind of a thing, and it would fall very directly on the parents. And it's not just, "Thou shalt not go into a harlot." It is, "You shall not make your daughter one." But still, I thought, you know, because of 1 Corinthians 6:15, we would essentially equate those, you know, in general. And then Deuteronomy 22, verse 5, forbids what we sometimes refer to as cross-dressing or transvestism, but where men would wear those things that are usually associated with women. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 9, you saw that especially on Sunday morning last, is referenced in the word effeminate in the New American Standard. Which word in the New American Standard really doesn't get, as we talked about in the Corinthian class, to the full nature, the horror of what that word actually means in 1 Corinthians. So effeminacy, in our way of thinking, is, you know, a man who wears dresses. Now, the first time I ever saw this, brethren, I remember just being so shocked. I was at the Veterans Hospital, and here was this guy, you know, there getting his appointment. And it was very apparent that few people, you know, had ever tried harder to make a show out of themselves. He was just putting on the Ritz. And, you know, and so he had to have everybody's attention and loud and all the rest of this, you know. And it was just spectacular to see this abomination, as it's called in Scripture. So, 1 Corinthians 6, verse 9, with regard to effeminacy. Effeminacy in the Greek culture of 1 Corinthians 6 is a good deal more than just presenting yourself in this manner. So again, for you know, the R rating warning and all of that, what the word has to do with in 1 Corinthians 6 is a homosexual pedophilic relationship. It's homosexual pedophilia that word is really talking about. This was a relationship between adult men and children of the same sex that was very common in the culture of their time. So we made the point at that time, you know, that just rearranges your whole brain when you even think about it. But really prominent and understood and accepted in the culture of the time the Christians were dealing with, you know, 2,000 years ago. Fortunately for us, it hasn't gotten that bad yet. But what has been the history of virtually every nation, you know, throughout antiquity? You'll get there sooner or later, you know, however long it takes. Once you abandon completely your respect for the God of heaven and certainly His Word, then there's no telling how low you may descend into what the Bible calls abominations. So we're well on the way. It was interesting, you know, I'm sure we all had mixed emotions 2 days ago, I think it was, when the Notre Dame, you know, building burned in Paris. Well, that's a disaster, you know, that is a disaster. Now, for us as Christians, it's a thing of great mixed emotions, though. Here is this atrocity, one of the earlier apostasies that has just innumerable doctrines, the antithesis of everything Scripture teaches, a substitute religion that has been the most dominant counterfeit religion, trying to ape and take people away from Christianity, claiming to be Christianity, you know, in the history of the world. They've been around, you know, at least since roughly about 300s AD. That's a long time for any group to be around. Took them 200-300 years to become identifiable in abandoning one doctrine after another and contradicting Scripture one after the other, to become recognizable in an incipient form to what we know today. So, you know, here is this one of their greatest, most cherished objects that they've used as a sort of evangelistic tool, you know, and it burns, and you have to have mixed emotions. Number one, I'm hoping that you at least watched a little bit of the videos on that.
because it will certainly help you to understand what the fall of Jerusalem and the burning of that temple in 70 AD would have looked like. They are both stone structures on the outside that were full of flammable materials on the inside. So in the end, you know, it's gutted and it's burnt out like that. But the Romans were so mad at the Jews in that time that they then, quite unwittingly, but certainly very specifically, verbatim, fulfilled the prophecy in the entirety of Matthew chapter 24. So what did they do to the standing stones after the fire went out? They fixed it so not one stone here was left upon another. So at least from that standpoint, I watched for a little while and thought, well, this is probably the best approximation I'm going to see of what the temple in Jerusalem would have looked like while it was burning. But, well, I don't rejoice, certainly. The scripture forbids that. We've talked about that. Never rejoice when your enemies fall. These are certainly avowed enemies of God, but we, you know, have to not rejoice over that lest God see it and turn away. So you have to, you know, try to walk that thin line. I'm not rejoicing over it at all, but I at least found it extremely ironic that France, which traditionally back through the centuries has been so predominantly and preeminently Catholic, today has how many actual practicing Catholics in their country? And you'll see varying, you know, representations, but they can't even crack 10%. It's unbelievable. They long ago abandoned that religion. And so now you see all this terrible weeping and lamenting and everything over what? Well, they're standing up there all of them talking about how precious it is as a religious thing. You know, there's not 10% of them even that were involved in it religiously at all. So, all I'm saying here, you know, is that when we look at these things, we are to stand up to this day and espouse the doctrines of our God no matter what happens to us. Maybe somebody come along and burn our building down one of these days on purpose because of the things we teach. Here is a list in the Old Testament, the vast majority of which, sexual sins only being discussed at this time, the vast majority of which you cannot find in the New Testament. These six are stated in one form or another. So we closed the class last week with just taking note. If we are to abandon this list today as the definition of sexual sins, then turn exclusively to the Old Testament for our list of sexual sins. We will be left with only these six things that God specifically forbids in the New Testament. Porneia is the general term in Greek, New Testament, for illicit sexual activity. My conviction, at least, so far as that goes, is that porneia should be defined the way God always has defined it. These things would fit into that category. So, my conviction is, these moral laws have never changed. And the idea that just because you can't read this list in the New Testament means that we're not subject to this list, or that somehow because these various things, all these many forms of incest, you know, aren't listed in the New Testament, that we're not, prohibited from practicing these things, in my view at least, is certainly incorrect. I believe that when you're looking at porneia in the New Testament, this is how God defined it then. This is how God defined it before Moses. This is how God will always define it. It's how he defines it now. If you want to know what the list of sexual sins is, you go to Exodus, you go to Leviticus, and you go to Deuteronomy today to find out what God considers. I'll throw this up and then take your comment, Bill. What God considers abominations. So, I did point out last week, the first time you get your word abomination in the Bible is here in Leviticus 18, as we studied last week. 24 times, because everything in the list is summarized at the end as being an abomination. And these 24 are all of a sexual nature. There were five more we pointed out last week that at least some would seem certainly, and others, not sure if it's actually talking, you know, metaphorically about idolatry or not, but they would seem to be sexual. And if that's the case, then we would have a total of 29 out of these 50, some 59, that are sexual in nature. Probably I pointed out because 1 Corinthians 6:18, where you should flee fornication. Every form in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. Every other sin a man commits is outside the body, but that fornicator, sexual sinner, sins against his own body. Okay, Bill, here's a good place.
Okay, and something I don't remember seeing in the Old Testament. We know they have to make a multitude of sacrifices for every little thing they do wrong. There are certain set feasts and feasts of the new moons that they gather for. But did they have regular worship periods when they gathered to learn?
That is a great question, and is especially important when you're studying with Seventh-day Adventists. Okay, I don't think, though you all need to go, you know, and look for it, but I don't think that I've been able to find a passage which says, "Thou shalt worship on Saturdays." That's a very different thought than "Thou shalt not work on the Sabbath." Okay, a lot about not working. I don't remember ever finding anything that says this is the one day of the week where you're supposed to get together in assemblies to worship God and take your Sabbath school, you know, classes. That's the way the Adventist reads it. That's what they get out of it. But I think the direct answer to your question, Bill, is no. They were to stay home, not go wandering around looking for a place to meet. The synagogues were invented apparently during the time of the Babylonian captivity, and some suspect by Ezra, but there's no direct biblical information on that either. The synagogues, though, are in place, fully functional, and apparently endorsed by Jesus when you get to the New Testament. At least he's certainly going in there, he's certainly using them, you know, so nobody was forbidden to be a part of one. But insofar as I know, I haven't been able to find a place that says in God's Word that the Jews were supposed to worship, to assemble for worship on Saturdays. There were convocations, there were assemblies that were stipulated, but a weekly one is unknown to me. Okay? So let's now move on in to new material, try to finish 19 and 20 here this evening. But I thought we'd do, rather than just reading on, since it's coincidentally in both the 1 Corinthians class as well as this class, we've been dealing with these lists of sexual sins. Let's finish the list of sexual sins by going to Leviticus chapter 19 first at verses 20 through 22. Now, if a man lies carnally with a woman who is a slave, acquired for another man, but who has in no way been redeemed, she's another man's slave, 100%. Nor given her freedom. She's another man's slave, 100%. There shall be punishment. They shall not, however, be put to death because she was not free. And he shall bring his guilt offering to the Lord to the doorway of the tent of meeting, a ram for a guilt offering. So there you go, Bill. It is, and there's a sacrifice for that crime. The priest shall also make atonement for him with the ram of the guilt offering before the Lord for his sin which he's committed, and the sin which he's committed shall be forgiven him. Now, we briefly mentioned that last week, so I'm just going to jump. Sorry, I didn't mean to do that. I'm going to jump on into now the longer section in Leviticus chapter 20, verses 10 through 21. So, you know, you might draw a big bracket on the page there, but here's another list of sexual sins. Leviticus 20, verse 10. If there is a man who commits adultery, well, we've already seen that forbidden back in Leviticus 18. It was death penalty attached to it now. With another man's wife, one who commits adultery with his friend's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. So, when the Pharisees came to Jesus, we caught this woman in the very act. What do you think we ought to do? What was so very notoriously missing? The guy that was involved in this capital offense. So in the very act, you know, here they are tempting Jesus and setting Jesus up. You know, they're being totally dishonest. They're being hypocritical. They're not practicing their own law. But in this case, when it's clear, now bear in mind, we have not yet been studying the requirements judicially for an individual to actually be put to death. What does it require? A minimum of two and preferably three witnesses. And by the way, you will learn eventually when we get to Deuteronomy 22. That amazing passage about, or maybe it's Numbers 22 as I think about it, but Numbers 22 about the waters of bitterness. God does not count himself as a witness in a death penalty case that the Jews are supposed to figure out on their own. So with the waters of bitterness, God would identify whether or not a woman had been an adulteress. And the husband, he's suspicious. God's testimony is not enough with through the waters of bitterness for her to be put to death. You don't have the witnesses. So it is a great fallacy to think all adulterers are put to death. Seldom, hardly ever, and never in the biblical record do you have an adulterer or adulteress put to death. There's no witnesses. Even David, no witnesses. Or if there are witnesses, then God chooses to make an exception in his case. Whichever one that plays out to be, hard to tell, still, adulteresses and adulterers were not put to death. Hardly ever. So don't think that. You can't get the witnesses. God had several other procedures for when you suspected it, even when God himself confirmed it. But you can't put them to death unless you got the witnesses. Don't have the witnesses, there isn't going to be a death. So in Leviticus 10, 20, verse 10, shall surely be put to death. But you'll learn elsewhere only if you can find the witnesses. 11. If there's a man who lies with his father's wife, there we go, 1 Corinthians 5 again, he has uncovered his father's nakedness, both of them shall surely be put to death. Their blood guiltiness is upon them. If what? If you got witnesses. If there's a man who lies with his daughter-in-law, both of them shall surely be put to death. But what will the other passages say about capital offenses if you got the witnesses? They've committed incest. Their blood guiltiness is upon them. There's a man who lies with a male as those who lie with a woman. Both of them have committed a detestable act. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood guiltiness is upon them. We had a very spirited discussion, you know, on Sunday morning about this very thing. However they got there, and I'm willing to grant it may be a wide variety of ways you got there. However you got into that condition, what does God say is the penalty? Put them to death. If only you can what? Find the witnesses. But it is a capital offense. So I suggested on Sunday morning, God's not likely, you know, to place a death penalty upon anything that the person cannot control, does not have control over. That's a whole study, very spirited. We'll talk about it again on Sunday morning. But just bear in mind, however you think that these people got into this abominable condition, they may not practice that behavior, or they're subject to the death penalty. So no matter how they got there, God forbids it.
A couple of things from the Old Testament that I remember different. If a woman is forcibly attacked and there is no witness, that's not only a single witness, also where someone's found murdered in the field and nobody has been a witness to the killing. It sounds like these are single witnesses.
Sounds like these are single witnesses?
Yeah. Well, it says where there's no witness, as I remember it. And that witness, not witnesses.
I don't think so, Bill. I don't think it says there's one witness. I think it says there's no witnesses. And then in the explanations that are related to that, the difference between the field and the city is that out in the field, she may have cried out, but nobody knows. But since we don't know, we have to give her the benefit of the doubt that she did cry for help and tried to stop it, so she may not be put to death. But if in the city, where if she cries out, she will be heard, no, she didn't cry out, then she gets put to death. But, you know, this, you know, has to do, again, with witnesses, and has to do with circumstances that, you know, is up to the judges. That's what you have a judicial system in God's word for the Jews and for us today to determine. So you go to trial and you have to figure that out.
I think what he's trying to say is that the word says witness, not witnesses. So he's wondering about the plurality of that. But that's the same argument about children. You may have children, but you may only have one child.
That's correct, and I really don't want to take the time to get into that one. But there's a lot of controversy about those qualifications. But yeah, that is correct. As I understand the grammar, and only Faye can tell us for sure. We've been there before. She's our grammar expert. You know, but as I understand it, if it says there is no witness, then I would at least start with zero. Yeah, and I wouldn't make too much of a play on the lack of an S, you know, and assume then that there might have been one, you know, but not two. I think at least it would say there weren't any, and so they're not enough. Okay, so let's continue here. And in verse 12, you have the daughter-in-law. In verse 13, male with male. And then in 14, man marries a woman and her mother. Fornication, both he and they shall be burned with fire. There may be no fornication in your midst. If there's a man who lies with an animal, he shall surely be put to death. You shall also kill the animal. If there's a woman, which suggests, brethren, I make only this comment, this is an act that is so heinous in its nature that even the poor animal gets defiled. It's just an abomination on every conceivable nature, you know, and level, and so you can have to kill even the animal. Then in 17, if there's a man who takes his sister, his father's daughter, or his mother's daughter, so he sees her nakedness, she sees his, it's a disgrace, they shall be cut off in the sight of the sons of their people. He has uncovered his sister's nakedness, he bears his guilt. If there's a man who lies with a menstruous woman and uncovers her nakedness, he's laid bare her flow, and she has exposed the flow of her blood. Thus both of them shall be cut off from among their people. You shall also not uncover the nakedness of your mother's sister, of your father's sister, for such a one is made naked his blood relative. They shall bear their guilt. If there's a man who lies with his uncle's wife, he's uncovered his uncle's nakedness. They shall bear their sin. They shall die childless. There's a man who takes his brother's wife. It is abhorrent. He has uncovered his brother's nakedness. They shall be childless. Now, I know a lot of questions, again, will crop up, you know, with regard to these, but especially there is what is called a Levirate and not a Levite. There is what is called a Levirate and not a Levitical marriage. The Levirate marriage, which is not related to the tribal circumstances, states that if your brother gets married and then he dies an untimely death, apparently young and doesn't have any kids, that the brother must go in to his neighbor's to his brother's wife and father a child to his brother's name. So there are stipulated exceptions as well. And no doubt we could spend weeks, you know, just working through all of these sexual sins. Now, I would much prefer to leave it now, you know, and just leave it with you, as there are a lot of questions here. And so you can go ahead and sort that out however you see. But in my humble opinion, you know, if you're going to find anywhere in your Bible a definition of prohibited sexual behaviors, you're going to find it here. It'll be here. This is what it is, New Testament or Old. These are the crimes. I don't think God's changed. I don't think men and women has changed. I can't imagine any way God would decide to call that lengthy list of abominations suddenly whole and clean and perfect and upright. They are naturally repulsive. We are by nature revulsed by these things. I think the very fact that most people just gag and want to vomit when they have to read the chapter indicates that they are immoral. We recognize that by nature, the same way I think Romans 1 says you can know by nature or do by nature the things contained in the law. So that's where I am on that. Now, somebody else had a hand up. I think, okay, Bill, it's your last card. Okay, go ahead.
Well, during many of the years of the old Jewish nation, there were probably a lot of men who were killed in combat, childless. And their brothers that remained, if they already had a wife, did they take their brother's wife to be another wife, or was it just a temporary thing to have a child?
This is another one of those things where, you know, it's hard to answer the question. What it's stipulated is only that you have to raise up the child, you know, to your brother's name, or you have to produce the child for your brother's name. I don't know how to answer that question. If there is an answer to that question, it has eluded me. So you're right. It doesn't stipulate then, you know, to my knowledge. Now, it may. I freely admit, you know, I learned stuff every day. I had to change the chart. Thanksgiving, Lee, you know, you got to keep working on it. This is a big topic. I don't claim to be the absolute master on it. So there may be, you know, a marriage that takes place, and then, you know, that's it for the rest of their lives. But I rather think not. That would create a lot of problems, I can imagine, anyway. So I don't think that's the case. Okay, that having been said, somebody else? Pardon me?
This was practiced back, well back into Genesis.
Okay.
Judah.
Okay.
Had sons.
Yeah, so see, that's it. There's a lot of really interesting material here, and I don't think I've ever met the man who really felt like, you know, I've got all this sorted out, because there's just a lot of kind of caveats and ways to figure on that. So those that are absolutely certain you got all the answers, you know, they kind of worry me sometimes. I keep growing and changing, and I don't know how they got to the pinnacle. But in Leviticus 19:2, it says, as we start our class tonight, in Leviticus 19, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to all the congregation of the sons of Israel and say to them, 'You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. I have a twofold purpose for wanting to get to the sexual stuff and then look at the ends of these chapters before I take you through the bulk of chapters 19 and 20. So we've already finished one of those purposes, keep the sexual sins together. Number two is I want you to note this statement at the head of 19, because I believe it will in itself answer a lot of questions for us on a whole bunch of laws that are not sexual in nature. So see that. You speak to the congregation, you shall be holy, the whole congregation, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Now you'll see on the screen again that also, it didn't come up, there it is. If you'll turn to chapter 20 now, and verse 26, the next to the last verse in that chapter, "You are to be holy to me, for I, the Lord, am holy. And I have what? Set you apart from the peoples to be mine." We are about to embark in the next 20 minutes on what I hope will be two full chapters with a number of statements that are extremely mysterious, that have just really befuddled us, you know, today. I think probably this is actually our answer, somewhere couched in these terms, which these passages begin and end with, may be at least a clue to understanding some of these things that are so weird to our thinking. Before we do that, though, please note there may not be nearly as much difference between the Old Testament and the New, and especially moral requirements that God has for us. When you see in 1 Peter 1, verses 14 through 16, says exactly the same thing. And is quoting this passage, these two passages, when it does. "Do not be conformed to the former lusts, which were yours in your ignorance. But like the Holy One who called you, be holy yourselves also in all your behavior. Because it is written, 'You shall be holy, for I am holy.'" Now, I'm suspecting that when it comes to moral relationships, and particularly by that what I mean is interpersonal human relationships, where the human bodies and relationships and all, you know, have never changed, that coming of an old law and a new law and all that doesn't change anything. There are certain things that I believe are in the category of you know, could know by nature or will have found written, like this list of sexual sins, that are what God uses before Moses, during Moses' 1500 years, that little period of time in the earth's history, and after Moses in Christianity. God wants us to be set apart. But particularly now for the Jews, he is using them as a figure or a symbol or a type, as we find Hebrews discussing, a type of what was to come. So, this holiness apart from other peoples to be gods and to be like him might answer some of our questions, as you'll see in a moment. So now let's go back to chapter 19. And here we go first with verse 3. Every one of you shall reverence his father and his mother. And you and you shall keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God. Do not turn to idols or make for yourselves molten gods. I am the Lord your God. When you offer sacrifice of peace offerings to the Lord, you shall offer it so that you may be accepted. It shall be eaten the same day you offer it and the next day. But what remains until the third day shall be burned with fire. So, it is if it is eaten at all on the third day, it is an offense. It will not be accepted. Everyone who eats it will bear his iniquity. He has profaned the holy thing of the Lord. That person shall be cut off from his people. So, if you want to make a bracket, verses 5 through 8 are peace offerings. But we had the whole of chapter 3 on peace offerings. So, I'm going to spend time on it tonight. Just another reference to peace offerings. The whole third chapter deals with these verses 5 through 8. But so far, reverence your father, keep the Sabbath, don't make idols, and then peace offerings. Here comes 9. Now, when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, neither shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest, nor shall you glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather the fallen fruit of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the needy and for the stranger. I am Yahweh your God. Those two verses are on the topic of gleaning. Gleaning is God's requirement that those people take note and recognize there will be poor people, there will be beggars. These people are to be helped in this manner. So, you got a big field, you're doing okay. Be careful, you don't go out there and grab every single grape. Leave some for others. Then, you have 11, you shall not steal. Well, we had that in Exodus 20. Nor deal falsely, nor lie to one another. Well, we had those in Exodus chapter 20 of the Ten Commandments. And then in 12, you shall not swear falsely by my name so as to profane the name of your God. I am the Lord, or I am Yahweh. Again, Exodus 20. 13, you shall not oppress your neighbor nor rob him. There's Exodus again. The wages of a hired man are not to remain with you all night until morning. You shall not curse a deaf man. It just means you always had to pay a guy at the end of every day. That was required under the old law. 14. You shall not curse a deaf man, nor place a stumbling block before the blind, which would just be malicious mischief, but you shall revere your God. I am Yahweh. You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor defer to the great, but you are to judge your neighbor fairly. Impartiality is required in the Old Testament just as well as it's required in the New. Same, same. 16. You shall not go about as a slanderer among your people. You are not to act against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. Same, same, Old Testament or New. You shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. You may surely reprove your neighbor, but shall not incur sin because of him. Same, same. You shall not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. That was not news to the people Jesus was preaching to from the Sermon on the Mount on. Same, same. No big, great gulf of difference. No, standard where the Jews could get away with things that God didn't used to like and then forbid, but would allow to them only and then take those rights away again. It's just same, same. Now, I really wish that here, with what Jesus designated in verse 18 as the second greatest of all commandments, you might want to make a note at Mark 12, verses 28 through 31. I wish we could just stop right there, or at least I wish we could then just skip to verse 20 that we've already read. Somehow I wish we could just expunge that verse 19 for two reasons. Number one, I don't know what in the world he's talking about there when it comes to why. We know the what. The what's no problem at all. The why is truly a great mystery. I don't know. Okay? And number two, therefore, this is one of the all-time favorite passages of those who are Bible skeptics. They just love that verse. How stupid, how foolish, how ignorant, how provincial, how blah, 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 whatever, you know, insult you can think of. And you guys who call yourselves Christians, you don't believe this stuff, you don't practice this stuff anymore, and you don't understand, you know, anything about this verse. But to them, it's just this easy card to play that you're all a bunch of morons. So here's 19. You are to keep my statutes. You shall not breed together two kinds of your cattle. You shall not sow your field with two kinds of seed, nor wear a garment upon you of two kinds of material mixed together. Well, hoorah, let's just start all the mockery right now. And you've all probably faced it. It drives you crazy. You know, people just get all, you know, up in arms and think that they've got some kind of incontrovertible argument. Now, let me just show you a list of possibilities. How do we understand these verses? I have by no means exhausted this list. But for instance, here's a guy in his commentary, a Thomas Constable, and he says, most of ancient Near Easterners believed all things were born into being. This was a major tenet of their belief system. They believed that not only animals were born, but also plants. This is the reason that they were forbidden to sow their field with two kinds of seed. Because, in that culture, he's saying, male and female, as they thought of it. So he says, he thinks he's found in ancient literature, the idea that if you put two kinds of seed out there, corn, you know, and soybeans, that there was some way these would be considered, you know, male and female, and there was a prohibition against putting the two together lest they mate somehow. Well, that doesn't seem hardly likely to me, and I don't know how in the world you could confirm this idea, but, you know, that's his way of trying to figure it out. Here comes Walton, Matthews, and Chevalis in their commentary. They say, the mixture of wool and linen was used in the tabernacle and in the high priest's garments, and it was thus reserved for sacred use. Now that starts to sound probable, doesn't it? He says, this interpretation is also current in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And don't you love God's providence that we just had Don Patton here preaching on the Dead Sea Scrolls and pointing out that what the liberal press is never going to tell you is that apparently they were also collecting scriptures from the Christians. Mark's Gospel, for instance, he showed us. Fragment seems to have been found in the collection of the Dead Sea Scrolls. So he was pointing out that they also understood Old Testament, our books, Old Testament prophecies, as speaking of a man who was to come and fulfill those prophecies. Well, this, of course, would indicate Jesus. But the way he says is, this interpretation is current in the Dead Sea Scrolls, that the mixture of wool and linen forbidden here to the general population was a part of the high priest's outer garments and used in the tabernacle. So he says, sowing of two types of seed is also prohibited in the Hittite laws with a death threat to the violators. Well, we don't care about the Hittite laws except to take note. Back in the culture at that time, there's something going on to answer the why question that God chose not to record in the book. I don't know how to verify these statements about Hittite laws either, and I won't spend a minute trying to dig them out. I don't think it's worth that much effort. But that's interesting. and I think more helpful. Here comes a third one. It's from a very famous commentary by three guys named Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Quote, this precept, like the other two. Now, he's particularly talking about the sewing of two fabrics into one garment. This precept, like the other two, was in all probability designed to root out some superstition. And accordingly, Maimonides, a famous Greek commentator, informs us that he found it enjoined in old magical books that the idolatrous priests should clothe themselves in garments of linen and woolen mixed together for the purpose of performing their ceremonies, pagan ceremonies. A secret virtue was attributed to this mixture of cloths, Maimonides says, hundreds of years ago. And I wouldn't begin to know how to find it or to verify it. But, he says, the law, it is to be observed, did not prohibit the Israelites wearing many different kinds of cloths together, only the two specified in this passage. Those two kinds of cloth were not allowed to be sewed together. Well, that adds another layer of, I think, even more helpful possibilities. And then comes this last one, which is even more helpful and simultaneously tries to shoot down what I thought was the most helpful. Okay, so, quote, this now is Kyle and Delage. I misspelled them. All the symbolical, mystical, moral, and utilitarian reasons that have been supposed to lie at the foundation of these commands, witness the first three that they're talking about now, all these ideas, are foreign to the spirit of the law. And with regard to the observance of them, the statement of Josephus and the rabbins, Maimonides would have been one of those rabbis, you all know who Josephus is, that the dress of the priests, as well as the tapestries and curtains of the tabernacle, consisted of wool and linen, is founded upon the assumption, which cannot be established, that the Hebrew word is a term that applies to linen. So they say, you know, tempting and, you know, interesting as all those are, can you prove it? No. So, do you know what God told the Jews they couldn't do? Did they understand what they couldn't do? Could they understand the what well enough to obey it? Do we know the why? No. So what should we be very satisfied with? Not knowing. It's a secret thing that belongs to God. He didn't tell us. That's another reason why I don't like getting into all the weeds about all the sexual sins when you're dealing with slaves and you know, betrothals, and we don't even practice betrothals today. And there's just a host of things in there. You know, we wouldn't begin to know how to do waters of bitterness, for instance. You know, and so when you don't have data from God, what should you conclude? God didn't want everybody for all time to know. Surely those Jews could practice these things. But some of them are arcane and esoteric and unknown to us. So, as soon as you figure out, Lee, what verse 19 is talking about, you write your book, I'll buy it. In the meantime, I don't know. Okay, let's go to verse 20. Let's not, because we already read all of that. So let's get down to verse, where is it? It's 23. When you enter the land, I think that's critical. When you enter the land and plant all kinds of trees for food, then you shall count their fruit as forbidden. 3 years it shall be forbidden to you, it shall not be eaten. But the fourth year all its fruit shall be holy, an offering of praise to the Lord. Some kind of separation between the previous administration of Canaanites run out by the Jews and these new ones that are coming into the promised land has to be made. Take 3 years. Four. In the fifth year, you're to eat of its fruit, that its yield may increase for you. I am the Lord your God. You shall not eat anything with the blood, nor practice divination or soothsaying. You shall not round off the side growth of your heads, nor harm the edges of your beard. This is number two most employed, you know, mockery of New Testament Christianity today that people use. Probably as well I think, like the previous ones, most likely had to do with idolatrous practices of that day in that land. That's what I think would probably cover those mysterious commands. Likely, my view is, all of them, including this last one, would have to do, not the last one, the next one's got the tattoos, you shall not make any cuts in your body for the dead, nor make any tattoo marks on yourselves, I am the Lord. All right, so everybody you've ever seen with a tattoo, you know, is a sinner. Well, not so sure, because of these statements about going into the land, defiling yourself, separation from them. I suspect they didn't put tattoos on because they thought it was cool. I suspect they put tattoos on because it was a part of their pagan and idolatrous worship. The same goes with the cutting of the hair. But, brethren, it's only speculation. Does anybody know? No. So we don't know. Be happy you don't know. I got to leave it there. God didn't say. But they were also in 29, not to profane your daughter by making her a harlot, so the land may not fall to harlotry and the land become full of lewdness. You shall keep my Sabbaths and revere my sanctuary. I'm the Lord. Do not turn to mediums and spiritists. He tells us again, do not seek them out to be defiled by them. I'm the Lord your God. You shall rise up before the gray-headed and honor the aged. You shall revere your God. I am Yahweh. When a stranger resides with you in your land, you shall not do him wrong. The stranger who resides with you shall be to you as the native among you. You shall love him as yourself. For you were aliens in the land of Egypt. I am Yahweh your God. You shall do no wrong in judgment, in measurement of weight or capacity. You shall have just balances, just weights, a just ephah, and a just hin, fluid measurement. I'm the Lord your God who brought you out from the land of Egypt. You shall thus observe all my statutes and all my ordinances and do them, for I am the Lord. Now, again, brother, I'm really truly sorry, but I got to hold you for a while. I don't want to leave, you know, just a small part of chapter 20. So, we're going to finish chapter 20 tonight. I want to read the parts we didn't. In 20 verse 1, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, you shall also say to the sons of Israel, any man from the sons of Israel or from the aliens sojourning in the land, in Israel, who gives any of his offspring to Molech, shall surely be put to death. Now, you'd have witnesses for that. That was a public event. You sacrifice your child to this fire god. You know, that human sacrifice and that of a child is absolutely abhorrent, but you would do it publicly on purpose. You'd have plenty of witnesses for that one. The people of the land shall stone him with stones. I'll also set my face against that man and will cut him off from among his people. Well, that's really interesting, because I don't know how to define cut off from his people. Sometimes it apparently means put them to death. Other times it seems like this one to indicate something else. We're going to kill him and what? He's cut off from among his people. Well, death will pretty well kill you. You know, I'm so blind, I mistook Jonathan for James over there. I only just now realized it. There's where my fingers should go. Okay, verse 3. Set my face against that man, and I'll cut him off from among his people, because he's given some of his offspring to Molech, so as to defile my sanctuary and profane my holy name. We're familiar with that. If the people of the land, however, should ever disregard that man when he gives any of his offspring to Molech so as not to put him to death, then I myself will set my face against that man, against his family, and I'll cut off from among their people both him and all those who play the harlot after him by playing the harlot after Molech. As for the person who turns to mediums and to spiritists to play the harlot after them, I'll also set my face against that person and will cut him off from among his people. Note here also this cutting off sometimes is not something the people do. It's something only God does. What is it? I'm not quite sure. Certainly not counted as a faithful soul before God. It won't be in the kingdom, but what else might that entail? I don't know. And you shall keep my statutes and practice them. I am the Lord who sanctifies you. If there's anyone who curses his father or his mother, he shall surely be put to death. He's cursed his father or his mother. His blood guiltiness is upon him. Truly, we would have a much better society if we would practice that law. Those that can be that rebellious against even parents certainly aren't going to respect anybody else. These are, you know, the biggest troublemakers you'll ever find. Now, we can wrap it up because we've already read everything 10 through 21, the last few verses starting in 22. You are therefore, I always try to take note of words like that, to keep all my statutes and all my ordinances and do them, that the land to which I am bringing you to live will not spew you out. It's all vested in the land and their inheriting and owning and remaining in it. Moreover, you shall not follow the customs of the nation. I think these summary verses are profoundly important when you got a question mark. You wonder, well, can I wear a tattoo or not? There was something going on about the customs of the nations then that was driving some of these laws, methinks. Moreover, you shall not follow the customs of the nation which I shall drive out before you. For they did all these things, and therefore I have what? Abhorred them. Hence I've said to you, you're to possess their land. I myself will give it to you to possess it. A land flowing with milk and honey. I am Yahweh your God, who has separated you from the peoples. You are therefore to make a distinction between the clean animal and the unclean, between the unclean bird and the clean. You shall not make yourselves detestable by animal or by bird or by anything that creeps on the ground, which I have separated for you as unclean. Now, brother, we spent a lot of time on that. Jesus would later declare, while he was still under the law, that these animals are clean. What's going on? Surely he's not contradicting Moses, is he? I don't think so. God made these things unclean for a certain people in a certain place for a certain length of time. But inherently, at least when it comes to the dietary laws, which are not moral, then he could establish a law that he would do away with, because no morality, which would go to the nature and image of God, is being violated. But it might have had to do with the idolatrous practices of the people in that land. And God's ensuring that these people would remain the light to the world, separated from those old pagan practices. This is my personal speculation. 26. Thus you are to be holy to me. That's how it'll be. How you are holy is this way. For I, Yahweh, am holy, if I've set you and I have set you apart from the peoples to be mine. Now, a man or a woman who is a medium or a spiritist shall surely be put to death. They shall be stoned with stones, or blood guiltiness upon him. This is like the fourth time he's brought that up. So the next time you call that psychic hotline, you remember that. Okay. No, no. Class dismissed.